Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday, the 26th of October. Ari Berman joins us this hour. Last time he was on, it was concerning voter ID and voting measures around the country. Today, an equally interesting topic. And it's a piece that was published just recently in The Nation titled How the Austerity Class Rules Washington. He writes how in the midst of a massive unemployment crisis, when it's painfully obvious that not enough jobs are being created and the public overwhelmingly wants policymakers to focus on creating them, did the deficit emerge as the most pressing issue in the country? And why, when the global evidence clearly indicates that austerity measures will raise unemployment and hinder, not accelerate, growth, do advocates of austerity retain such distinction today? So that's the focus of this hour today. Ari is a contributing writer for The Nation magazine. He's an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute, author of Herding Donkeys, The Fight to Rebuild the Democratic Party and Reshape American Politics. I can assure you we already have a ton of comments, and we haven't even talked yet. On our Facebook page, we will have many, many callers this hour, and we welcome your thoughts on this. 800-486-8655. Is our number, 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. You can find the article on our Facebook page along with a number of comments, and that's the Kathleen Dunn Show. So put your comments there, and we'll keep this dialogue moving along for some time. Ari, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hey, good morning, Kathleen, and greetings from Colorado, where it's actually snowing at the moment.
What are you doing in Colorado?
I'm here to give a speech, and it was 80 degrees yesterday, and now it's 17 degrees and snowing today.
Oh, my gosh, it's 17 degrees, Ari.
So much for a hike, right?
Oh, my gosh, you'll just be in your room after the talk and drinking hot cocoa.
Or something like that.
Right. I was just reading that. I was just reading the news this morning because our producer, Rhonda, had been in Colorado, and I was saying, oh, you got out of there just in time because the flights here are going to be late today.
You guys will get it soon enough. Don't worry.
No. Don't say it. Well, Ari, you've got a real knack for writing about things that are very important and that people are really, truly interested in, and this is one of them. And it's a wonderful article. Please talk about this influential and aggressive austerity class that has kept the conversation on the deficit and not on jobs.
Sure, yeah. So that's really been a central paradox to me over the past two or three years, is how, as you mentioned, in the midst of this massive unemployment crisis, when the public overwhelmingly cares about jobs and believes not enough are being created, why are we focusing on the deficit? And not only why are we focusing on the deficit, but then why are we focusing on the deficit in a way through these austerity measures that would actually worsen the unemployment crisis? And so I looked at this and I found that basically there's this very large and influential group of self-proclaimed centrist deficit hawks at major think tanks, in the Congress, in the Obama administration, in the media, and they've been very, very successful at making the deficit into such a major issue, and then they've found common cause with supply-side conservatives, people like Paul Ryan, who I'm sure we'll talk about more. And really what's happened is the Republicans, who didn't care all that much about the deficit under George W. Bush, when George W. Bush turned Clinton's surplus into a $1.2 trillion deficit, they found true religion under Obama, and they became self-proclaimed fiscal conservatives. And so what you had in Washington is you had the Republican Party banging the drum on deficits, you had the centrists banging the drum on deficits, and that influenced to a great deal the Obama administration and the media and the general public into thinking that the deficit was the most pressing problem today, even though, as we know, the most pressing problem today should be and is the lack of jobs.
So the deficit is not something that philosophically conservatives will adhere to no matter what?
Well, I don't believe so. I believe, and I'm sure some conservative callers will call up and disagree with this, but I basically believe that conservatives like Paul Ryan particularly care about two things. They care about cutting government, and they care about cutting spending. We're never going to balance the budget. We're never going to reduce the deficit if we only try to do those two things and refuse over and over and over to raise taxes. So right now, if you were a deficit hawk, you would say, okay, maybe we're spending too much money, but we're also not taking in nearly enough money. I mean, revenue is at its lowest share of GDP since Eisenhower. So the question is, if you are a quote-unquote deficit hawk, the true measure of being serious is whether you're willing to raise taxes and cut spending in combination. At the last GOP, or I should say, at a few GOP presidential debates ago, I don't know whether, well, there's been so many debates at this point,
I forget
which one is which. But anyway, in one of the GOP presidential debates, all the candidates were asked, would you support a plan that is 10 to 1 spending cuts to tax increases? 10 to 1, which is incredibly unbalanced. And they all said no. They wouldn't even support a dollar of tax increases for every $10 of spending cuts. And when I hear that rhetoric, I basically think Republicans aren't serious about the deficit. So we should stop treating it as such. And then you have to look at what the so-called quote-unquote centrists are saying. I believe they have a predetermined agenda, and their predetermined agenda is to cut back on the social safety net and to redirect spending from the government into the private sector. So they would like the private sector to have a larger role, for example, in Medicare, a larger role in Social Security. And so they're always focusing on what the government is doing, and they always want to cut programs like Social Security and Medicare, even though if you look at the polling here, the public overwhelmingly wants more, not less, spending on Social Security and Medicare. So I really believe both the centrists and the conservatives have hijacked the debate over economic policy in this country and have pushed very unpopular measures to reduce the deficit that I don't think the public is that receptive to.
Mm-hmm. And why is it that the president, he's changed his tune now, and I want to talk about your thoughts on as to why he's changed his tune and how sincere it is, but why have he and his economic advisors like Geithner adhered to this deficit argument?
Yeah. So you have to remember, many of Obama's economic advisors, his principal economic advisors, came out of the Clinton administration. Tim Geithner, Larry Summers, Peter Orszag, and they were deficit hawks, and they viewed the balancing of the budget under Bill Clinton as good policy and good politics, and that's what was quote-unquote considered responsible economics in this country. Now remember, Clinton did that in a good economy, right? But nonetheless, what happened is these people entered the Obama administration wanting to do the same thing. They wanted to cut a quote-unquote grand bargain deal that would pare back Social Security and Medicare, cut government spending in return for more progressive policies like increasing taxes and health care reform. So that was their plan all along. They were devotees of Bob Rubin, who was Clinton's Treasury Secretary, and they had all come out of this think tank called the Hamilton Project that was founded at the Brookings Institution in 2006. And they made it very clear that they viewed the budget deficit as a huge, huge problem. And so Obama takes office at a time when the economic crisis is front and center, right? And everyone on the right and the left believes that we have to spend money, because when the private sector is paring back, when the public is spending less money, when there's a massive recession, only the government can spend money to get us out of this. So that's just sort of basic economics. And Obama buys this argument in the beginning, and he realizes he has to do some emergency spending in the form of the stimulus. But once he does the stimulus, and we have to remember, the stimulus, partly because of concerns of the deficit, is too small to actually make the difference that the Obama administration said it would. But after they do the stimulus, very quickly after that, they decide to start focusing on the deficit, because calls are rising in Congress to focus on the deficit, calls are rising in the think tank world to focus on the deficit. Republicans are saying, we're spending too much money, we just bailed out the banks, and now we have a stimulus, and government's out of control. And so the Obama administration pivots too soon. And even though the economy needs more stimulus, not less, they decide to start talking about, for example, a freeze on government spending.
Right.
And they start pushing all these policies that then lead us into more of an era of austerity. And they've basically been schizophrenic on economic policy ever since. And so it's only recently, after, for example, during the debt ceiling debate, John Boehner rejected Obama's quote-unquote grand bargain offer on the deficit. It's only after that when, number one, Obama realizes that he can't find a willing partner in Republicans to make a deal. And number two, the economy is so weak because there's been no government intervention recently to try to boost a stagnant economy, that basically he has no choice now but to introduce a jobs bill and pivot back to the issue of jobs. The problem is, for the last year, he's been telling the country what a big problem the deficit is. So the public, I think, right now is, I think, for very understandable reasons, quite confused about the problem today.
And you write in your piece that his new jobs plan may well be too little, too late.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that it is too little, too late, because, for example, if you look at the size of the plan, for example, Moody's says that it would create 2.1 million new jobs. Well, that's a lot of jobs, but that's not nearly enough jobs to get us out of the recession. So that's the too little part. The too late part is, it would have been nice if he introduced a plan like this when Democrats had control of the Congress and were able to pass things. But clearly you have a Republican Party that either for ideological or for self-interested reasons is unwilling to support anything major that the president does. And so I think the Republican Party is basically, number one, motivated by the idea that anything they do to help Obama improve the economy will help the president's reelection chances and hurt their chances. They don't want to do that. And then number two, I mean, Republicans have bought this argument, even though I think it's an incorrect argument, if you look at the data, that the stimulus failed, that the government can't do anything, that the only way that we can boost the economy is by cutting spending and cutting the deficit. Now, I have to tell you, every single reputable study finds that that is not true. It's called, quote-unquote, the myth of expansionary austerity. And the IMF and other organizations have looked at this, and they found that cutting spending in the midst of a recession will worsen the unemployment crisis, not help it. But nonetheless, they have bought this argument, and they keep pushing this argument, which makes it very difficult for the president to get anything done on the jobs front.
Let's talk a little bit more about Congressman Paul Ryan before we get to phone calls. You talk about in 2008, he introduced his budget roadmap, called for turning Medicare into a voucher system, privatizing Social Security, and redistributing income upward by cutting taxes for the wealthiest Americans and largest corporations. Does he still adhere to that roadmap, and is there great support for that roadmap?
Well, he has modified it slightly, but I think it's really important to say that Paul Ryan is not a deficit hawk. He is a starve-the-beast conservative. He wants the beast of government to be much, much, much smaller. And that's the only reason why you, for example, would privatize Medicare, privatize Social Security, cut tax on the richest Americans, and then end up raising them on the middle class, and you cut government to the size that we haven't seen since, you know, the 1950s, when programs like Medicare didn't even exist. And it's funny, if you look at his roadmap that he introduced in 2010, that plan would actually increase the deficit from a share of a 60% debt-to-GDP ratio that we have today to 175% over a period of time. So I don't really believe that Paul Ryan was that serious about the deficit. When he introduced his budget plan in 2011 that Congress subsequently passed, he did, over a period of 10 years, achieve around $155 billion in savings. So that was more, quote-unquote, fiscally responsible. But you have to ask yourself, at what cost, right? I mean, he was taking programs like Social Security and Medicare, which are the backbone of the social safety net, and he was essentially privatizing those programs. Then two-thirds of the cuts in his plan came from low-income and middle-class Americans, programs that benefited those people. So Pell Grants, Medicaid, food stamps, low-income housing. So essentially he's balancing the budget on the backs of the poor and the middle class without asking the rich for any sort of shared sacrifice. And that essentially is his plan today. How popular is it? I mean, you can see how popular it is. The minute Republicans passed it, they realized they made a huge mistake, and they've been trying to run away from the Ryan plan ever since. So when you see that 90% of Americans support Social Security and Medicare and want more spending on it, not less, you realize how unpopular it is to propose privatizing these programs. It was unpopular when George W. Bush tried to do it, and it was unpopular when Paul Ryan just proposed doing it not too long ago.
Yeah, people like the programs. People like them.
People like the programs, and they are well-run programs. And so it's funny, you know, people always talk about, for example, the waste and the fraud and abuse in these programs, but there's no doubt that Medicaid is and Medicare are run more efficiently than the private health insurance market, and Social Security is run very well. And so, and it's important to realize, number one, Social Security doesn't contribute to the deficit. There is a surplus in Social Security, and that will last until around 2040. So, yeah, long term, we have to do something about it. But the question is, why do we have to do something about it now? And you look at Medicare, for example. Medicare over time will increase as a share of the deficit and a share of the debt. But you can't solve the problem of Medicare without looking at the broader health insurance industry, without looking at the fact that, for example, we can't pay get cheaper drugs, for example, from Canada, the fact that we don't have a public insurance option, the fact that private insurance is so expensive that the U.S. pays more for insurance than any other industrialized country. And those are problems that are largely caused not by Medicare, but by the private insurance industry. So there's no doubt that the government is not perfect, but I think the demonization of government by a lot of these people who profess to care about the deficit is really misplaced.
And going back to jobs for just a moment, this massive unemployment crisis, you write, and I think this is very true, Ari, that most Americans, the public overwhelmingly wants the people in Congress, the president, to focus on creating jobs. What's the problem here? Is it adhering to a philosophical path and you can't budge from it? How can you not address what is the most significant problem in the country, getting people to work?
Well, when you see how unpopular Congress is right now, I mean, there's no doubt that there is a disconnect between our political leadership and the public, and that's existed for a long time. And I believe the reason that it's only getting worse is precisely because politicians are ignoring what the public wants. So poll after poll after poll, for ever since the recession has begun, said that the public wants policymakers to focus on jobs. That's been absolutely clear. Now, what's happened as these calls for the deficit, for decreasing the deficit and for tackling it, what's happened is public support has over time elevated that issue. It hasn't become more important than jobs, but the public has cared more about the deficit. And so you're in this situation where the more politicians talk about the deficit, the more alarmed the public is about it. And that creates what the Washington Post blogger Greg Sargent has called the deficit feedback loop, where basically what's happening is the more politicians talk about the problem, the more alarmed the public is, but yet what happens is the issue they care most about, which is jobs, keeps getting ignored precisely because of this loop. So this essential disconnect in Washington continues unabated, you know, month after month after month. And yes, you know, President Obama is belatedly focusing on it now, but there has just not been the constant focus on jobs from the Obama administration that I think a lot of people would like to see. And then the Republicans have done nothing about jobs since they've taken control of the Congress. Nothing that they've proposed would create any jobs. Their quote-unquote job proposals, independent economists have looked at them and they found that they're not going to create any new jobs and they're likely to make the recession even worse.
Ari Berman is our guest this hour, contributing writer for The Nation, investigative journalist, fellow at The Nation Institute. He has a very interesting piece, which is on our Facebook page. A listener put it up there, How the Austerity Class Rules Washington, in which he looks at this central question: how over the last 2 years has the deficit been the focus of conversation rather than creating jobs when massive unemployment is rampant? So let's go to you, and we'll do so in a moment. Our phone number, our lines are filled, but you'll be able to get through eventually. Here is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Ari Berman is our guest, joining us by phone from Denver, where yesterday it was 80 and today it's 17 and the snow is on its way. We go to Daniel in Janesville first. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. President Bush put us into debt more than any president in a long time. And Nothing said about that, and that's part of the the biggest part of the problem, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Kathleen, I guess I'll just go ahead and
yes, go right ahead.
But it is an important point the caller raises. So we had a surplus in the Clinton years, and George W. Bush really did a few major things that turned that surplus into a $1.2 trillion deficit. Number one, the 2001 and the 2003 Bush tax cuts. Number two, the Medicare Part D plan. And number three, the unpaid wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so if you care about the deficit, you would think that that would be the beginning of the conversation, is rolling back those Bush administration policies, ending the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, taking away the unnecessary Medicare Part D plan, which is basically just a huge subsidy to the private insurance industry through Medicare, and then putting the Bush tax cuts back to where they were in the Clinton era. Then if you look at where the deficit is now, the deficit increased because of the recession. So, you know, because we had this economic crisis, revenues went down, and there had to be some emergency spending through the stimulus, through increased unemployment benefits, through aid to states and local governments to keep them up and running. And that was a modest portion of the deficit. People say Obama caused the deficit. That's absolutely not true. Yes, some of the stuff he did increased it, but he has no choice. But if you start to grow the economy and you start to create new jobs, then a lot of that deficit problem would just disappear automatically, this short-term deficit problem. If you rolled back what happened under Bush and then you grew the economy under Obama, the deficit would start to disappear and become less of an issue. And that's where I really believe the conversation should be headed. It should be looking at those policies. It shouldn't be looking at, for example, Medicare or Social Security, which right now are not increasing the deficit like all these other programs are.
And is there something we should be looking at the Clinton administration to determine why there was a surplus then?
Well, what Clinton did is he got into office, he did a 50-50 spending cut to tax increases. So he cut some spending, and he also raised taxes. And so the tax rates, for example, for the highest Americans went up. And in large part, we had a surplus because of that, and because the economy grew very, very rapidly in the Clinton administration. I mean, any time you have an economy growing that quickly, revenues are going to go up, and that is going to decrease the deficit. And so it was really a combination of things that Clinton did from a policy standpoint and the growth of the economy. And we're seeing the opposite now. We're seeing an unwilling to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans in Washington, and we're not seeing policies pursued that would create new jobs. And that's pushing us into a vicious circle where the deficit increases, and then we say, okay, we need austerity measures to increase the deficit. And then what happens is the deficit gets even larger because revenues go down even more, and growth slows. And so that's what you're seeing, for example, in Britain, where their economy wasn't doing that bad. The coalition of the Conservatives and the Liberal Democrats took over there. They instituted these sharp austerity measures, and growth has really slowed to a halt there. And that's made their fiscal situation worse, not better.
No. Let's go to Pete in La Crosse. Hi, Pete.
Hi, Kathleen and Ari. It was interesting to hear Ari say earlier about how this is this jobs program and stimulus spending, at least this is where I think he was going with it, that this is all about making sure that the economy doesn't look particularly good during the election campaign of 2012. And I've been saying that for months, that this is all about making Obama look bad. We know that we've not had a president reelected with unemployment greater than 7.5% in this country. And if they can keep the unemployment at 9%, the Republicans are probably a shoo-in for the Oval Office. And I believe that's their goal. Your thoughts?
Well, Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, has said very clearly that his number one goal is defeating Barack Obama in 2012. And so you have to look at, if your overriding goal is to defeat the president, then you don't want to do anything that will actually help the president. And there's no doubt that nothing would help the president more than passing a jobs bill and getting some new jobs in the economy and getting the economy growing again. And if Obama is unable to do that, Republicans can turn around and they can say that, you know, it's all Obama's fault. He created the deficit, even though that's not true. He created the recession, even though that's not true. There's been a revisionist history, I think, about the economic crisis, about the causes of the economic crisis, and about the resulting debt and deficit that occurred as a result of the economic crisis and as a result of Bush administration policies. They're trying to tie that all to the president, which I don't think, quite frankly, is accurate.
Thanks, Pete, for your call. Daryl is next in southwest Wisconsin. Hi, Daryl.
Hi. There's around $2 to $2.5 trillion in the private sector, and what we need to do is to educate them and motivate them to invest it in areas that not only multiply money back to them, but create jobs and increase the tax revenue and so forth. And the way we can do that is if the media and everyone will focus on explaining to them that if they have a lot of money and they invest it in the stock market or in some of these other areas, they can lose it in a matter of a day or two. And that, in fact, trillions of dollars can be lost. However, if they invested in their homes and small businesses as far as making them energy efficient or changing to renewable energy, those who have money can do that. Then you help the economy in a multiplicity of ways. Now, I really agree with Obama where he's starting to bypass Congress, and this would bypass Congress and would jumpstart tax revenue so that then you could go and spend on the infrastructure and the whole problem would be resolved. Google Empowerment Communications. If you Google Empowerment Communications, it's come up first for years and years, and it explains how this whole thing happened for way back, decades back.
All right, Ari.
Well, that's why the president has proposed something, for example, like an infrastructure bank, which would be a public-private partnership that would give the private sector more of an incentive in, for example, the housing and the construction industries, which are very weak at the moment, to start spending again on new projects. And it's very clear that the private sector is not going to address this issue on its own. Banks are sitting on a lot of cash. The private sector, as the caller pointed out, is sitting on a lot of money, but they're being very cautious, just like the public is being very cautious. And that's why the government has to step in and has to take a larger role. So I think it's very important to get across to listeners that when the public and when the private sector is spending less money, the government has to spend more. And in times of crisis, we may need a bigger deficit, not a smaller one. And that sounds counterintuitive, but that is basic economics. So when politicians run around and they say in both parties, government is like a family, when families are tightening their belts, the government has to tighten its belt. That's absolutely untrue. In fact, it's just the opposite. And I think that's been one of the most deceptive arguments that the quote-unquote deficit hawks have made, because it sounds intuitive, right? You know, if I'm drowning in private debt, well, then the government can't be drowning in debt as well. But the problem is, as long as there is this problem of private sector debt, as long as people are underwater in their mortgages, as long as people aren't spending money, the government is the only force in American society that can make up for that. And that's why we saw with the stimulus saved about 3 million jobs, but it just wasn't big enough and it just wasn't sustained enough to actually make up for that lack of private sector demand and spending.
The answer I keep hearing when you ask the question, why is the private sector sitting on trillions of dollars, it's been a recent answer. It's been in the last maybe 6 months or so. It's because of excessive government regulations. And if we didn't have those regulations, we might be able to invest more.
There's just no evidence that that's the case. And then that's been another meme that's been promoted by a lot of people in business and a lot of people on the right. But really, if you look at new regulations, I mean, primarily, they've been on Wall Street. A lot of them haven't even gone into effect yet, and they're in place precisely to prevent another kind of recession like we just had. So there's a very good paper by Lawrence Michel of the Economic Policy Institute that deals with this problem. I'd urge people to go to epi.org and check it out. Paul Krugman has also written about this, but it's simply not true.
Ari Berman is our guest this hour. His piece in the current issue of The Nation is what we're talking about, how the austerity class rules Washington. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We go to Gerard in La Crescent, Minnesota. Hi, Gerard.
Hi.
Hi.
This may be a very naive question, but I am constantly asking myself this: if these policies of austerity that the Tea Party and the Republicans and deficit hawks are pushing is not going to help, why are these people being voted into office? And why doesn't the American public start voting against them? And I know that's a very simple question, but I'm constantly asking myself that.
It's a good question, and it's a simple question, but the answer is actually relatively complicated, because if you look at, for example, the aftermath of 2000 election and heading into the 2010 election, the public was very confused about the economic crisis, about why it occurred and why the economy wasn't getting better. And so they saw, for example, the bailouts, which were incredibly unpopular. Then they saw that followed by the stimulus. And so the public, I think, for understandable reasons, lumped those two together. And there was a feeling that, you know, government was just, quote-unquote, throwing money at the problem, that they were rewarding bad actors, and that it was really not the bank's fault, but it was the government's fault. And it was particularly excessive government spending that was prolonging the recession. Now, as I said before, that wasn't true, but it was a very enticing argument that Republicans were making. And it was difficult for Democrats to turn around and say, no, actually, the stimulus worked, but it just wasn't big enough, and we just didn't do enough. They could have made that argument, but it's not as simple of an argument as just saying the stimulus failed. And so that really was the backdrop for the 2010 election, and Republicans, I think, very brilliantly made the 2010 election a referendum on government spending, and the public equated the resulting private sector debt, so the fact that all this debt had been accumulated from the housing crisis, from the economic crisis, and they made the private sector debt, they equated that with the government debt. And they said, oh man, you know, if we have all this debt, if the government accumulates all this debt, well, it's going to be a similarly bad problem. And so really, that's been the dynamic in Washington for a long time. Now, you're asking, why won't they get voted out of office? Well, they might. They very well could get voted out of office. I mean, we're in a situation in 2012 right now where incumbents in both parties are very unpopular. Incumbents were unpopular in 2006, they were unpopular in 2008, and they were unpopular in 2010. And I have no reason to believe that the 2012 election won't be the fourth straight anti-incumbent election where a lot of people get voted out of office. Now, this is probably sort of besides the point, but it is important to remember there are things like redistricting. There are ways that politicians raise money that give the party in power something of a firewall to protect them. So it's not as easy to vote out people as we think it is, but nonetheless, the dissatisfaction in the public, I think, will result in a number of people being voted out of office.
Thanks, Gerard, for your call. Let's go next to Jerry in Wausau. Hi, Jerry.
I've been very disappointed at the way Democrats have failed to get the overall picture on the debt over to the public. I did the research a while ago, and it's amazing that in the 20 years that the two Bushes and Ronald Reagan were in office, that never once did the Gipper or either Bush have a balanced budget. Never once. And the other thing that's amazing and that the administration failed to get out more recently on the debt ceiling increase is that the Gipper had 17 debt ceiling increases. George Herbert Walker Bush and Bill Clinton each had four, Bush in his 4 years, Clinton in his 8 years. And then Bush Light came along, and he had seven of them during his years. And it just seems to me that Democrats just get out-PR'd by the conservatives all the time. The other thing is that if you start looking at the current deficit increases, that the wars, the two wars now, if you look at the yearly increase in the standard military budget, which is doubled from about $300 billion to over $600 billion, and then you look at the special appropriations for those two wars that we're been fighting, that you have $3 trillion in wasted money there, which is three times of what the total deficit from all administrations happened to be when Jimmy Carter left office. At that time, we had about $900 billion plus. We had never hit a trillion yet. So, again, my complaint is that I don't know why Obama didn't go on TV some evening and point out these factors, that what the Republicans did to our deficit over their 20 years.
It's a good point that the caller has made. I mean, Obama has a lot of times embraced this notion of false equivalency. So he says a lot in speeches, I think, because he's trying to appear bipartisan or postpartisan or nonpartisan or whatever, that both parties got us into this mess, that both parties got us into the recession, and both parties created the debt and deficit problem. And there's a grain of truth to that. But overwhelmingly, if you look at the deficit, it was caused by actions that Republicans took. It was caused, as I said earlier, number one, there was an incredible amount of spending during the Reagan years. I mean, just drunk amounts of spending, not only, you know, cutting taxes and spending an incredible amount of money on a military buildup. George W. Bush gets in. He spends a huge amount of money again on another military buildup. He gives people new programs, another round, two rounds of tax cuts that primarily benefit the wealthiest Americans. And so that's a very stark contrast, for example, how Bill Clinton managed the budget. And I think Obama would like nothing more than to tackle the deficit. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that he cares a lot about this issue, that he believes it's important. But I don't think he has adequately pointed out, number one, that Republicans have caused a lot of the problems, and that he has, in a way, been forced to exacerbate the problem, but has had no choice because of the recession, and that he doesn't have a willing partner here. And it's unfortunate to me, and a big problem in this discussion is the role that parts of the media play. So you see, for example, columnists like David Brooks and Tom Friedman from the New York Times, people on the Washington Post op-ed page, you see them saying over and over, we need a grand bargain on the deficit. And you're like, where were you guys when Obama offered John Boehner a grand bargain in July of 2011 and Boehner rejected it? Where were you when Republicans stood up and said they wouldn't support 10-to-1 spending cuts to tax increases? Where is the evidence that the current Republican Party is actually serious, actually cares at all about the deficit? And so basically, as long as the media keeps promoting the idea that both parties are equally responsible for this problem and both parties are equally unwilling to solve it, then the public will, I believe, rightly think that both parties are responsible for the problem, even though it's just simply not true. If you look at the numbers, if you look at the plans, and if you look at the recent history of deals that have been offered in the Congress.
And everybody, Ari, I think, is not in touch with what American people are going through right now, be it the media, be it people in Washington. Where's the, if it was real or not, the old Clinton, I feel your pain? Because nobody seems to be feeling anybody's pain, and the pain is all over.
The pain is all over, but the ruling class in Washington is very insulated from it. So number one, a lot of these members of the media are quite wealthy themselves.
Yes.
So they're not feeling the brunt of the recession. Then if you look at the deficit hawk groups in Washington, I mean, they are being bankrolled by large money on Wall Street. People like, for example, Pete Peterson, who was Nixon's commerce secretary, who was head of the private equity group, the Blackstone group. I mean, he's going to spend $1 billion on the deficit issue, raising alarm about, for example, Social Security and Medicare. These billionaires, they're not hurting right now. People at Washington think tanks, they're not hurting right now. Members of Congress, a lot of whom are overwhelmingly millionaires. I mean, that was the sort of dark secret of the Tea Party, was, you know, far from being a working class populist movement, I mean, a lot of members of the Tea Party were millionaires themselves. So they're not really feeling the recession. So the pain that people are going through has not been adequately reflected, I don't think, in the elite of both parties, and that's why it's been so hard for them to solve this crisis. You know, if high profile politicians suddenly didn't have a job, they might feel differently about the deficit. They might prioritize, for example, creating jobs over cutting spending right now.
Ari Berman is our guest this hour. His latest piece is How the Austerity Class Rules Washington, in which he writes about the history of attention to deficit versus attention to jobs, why it is that the deficit has been a focal point of conversation for the last 2 years, when the American people are saying we need work, we need jobs. Why hasn't that been the focus? And so that's what we're talking about, and our lines have been very busy. We have one opening now, 800-486-8655. You can also use an email if you'd like. That's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page has a continuing conversation from listeners about this as well, which you may want to check out. And you can also find the article at The Kathleen Dunn Show. That's on Facebook. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program, what's at stake in countries rich in biodiversity as the global population will soon reach 9 billion people? It creates too many people extraordinary problems. Our guest, Robert Draper, contributing writer for the National Geographic magazine, who's written a really interesting piece in the current issue, Rift in Paradise. So that's our number two. Ari Berman is here for a few more minutes. 800-486-8655 is our number. Matt in Appleton is next. Hi, Matt.
No, this is Mike.
Oh, Mike. I'm sorry, Mike.
That's okay.
Yeah. Hi, Mike.
I'd like to ask your guest the following question, and I'm not being facetious when I ask this question. Do you cover a payroll?
No.
Yourself personally?
No, I'm employed.
Okay. So,
but I have lots of expenses.
Okay, but I do cover a payroll, and I have the potential of maybe hiring a couple of people, but
yeah.
I ain't going to do it. And you know why? Because there's such a tremendous amount of uncertainty, and I blame the current administration for that. Now, you say, oh, you know, regulations is statistically, and, you know, we talk about all of this history and, you know, who's responsible. But let's get down to the nitty-gritty. I could hire two people today, but I'm not going to do it because of the uncertainty, because of tremendous, what I consider to be, over-regulation. You know, if I actually go and hire somebody, well, what does that mean? What do I have to go through? Am I going to risk my hard-earned capital to do something like that? Absolutely not.
What uncertainty
are you referring to?
Pardon me?
What uncertainty are you referring to?
Are you kidding? I mean, do you think that the small business person feels, you know, a sense of uncertainty as to what's going to happen?
But what particular regulations that are new regulations are making you not want to hire people?
Maybe it's not so much the regulation part. It's more the uncertainty part. I mean, you know, what's coming down the pike? If I go ahead and hire people, you know, am I going to be killed by taxes? The new medical regulation, you know, how is that going to affect me? Nobody's explaining that clearly.
All right, well, there we got something. The health regulations and possible new taxes.
And taxes. So, okay, let's take those separately. Because you hear this a lot, I mean, and part of this is just uncertainty relating to a bad economy. And I think we've pretty well established the fact that, you know, if the economy was improving, you know, if we were creating more jobs, some of that uncertainty would go away. But on the tax front, I think the president has made it clear he is going, if he could, to raise taxes on the top 1% of Americans, whether it's people raising $250,000 or whether it's people making over a million. There is some debate over the Congress of what should qualify as the wealthiest Americans. But they are talking about raising taxes on those people. They're also have been talking, and they have cut taxes for everyone else. So that's number one. Number two, with healthcare, I mean, the healthcare bill has not gone into effect yet. So it doesn't go into effect until 2014. My sense is that when it goes into effect, there will be a lot of provisions in the bill to assuage the small business owners that are concerned about the healthcare system. But right now, under the current healthcare system, businesses are paying for people's health care, too. So it's not like that's an ideal situation either. The employer-based health care system is giving a lot of people heartburn as well. So, I mean, that is one reason why progressives, for example, supported a public insurance option so that employers wouldn't be on the hook for health care, that government would cover that instead, and that would take away some of these burdens that businesses are feeling. So I do think that there are some real concerns. A lot of them, though, are, to me, fairly abstract, and they're a byproduct of a recession that the president did not create, and I don't think he's done as much of as he could to try to solve this problem. But I think if you look at, for example, the stimulus, things like that were a good first step, and they needed to be followed by a slew of more aggressive policies to get the economy out of the rut that it's in. And if we did that, a lot of this uncertainty would go away.
I think Mike speaks for a lot of people, Ari. I think you would agree that this uncertainty is keeping people from hiring people. They're blaming the administration. Is there a failure to communicate here on the part of the administration concerning policies? Or how can people have so many deep concerns about what will happen with their small business taxes and with health care? You hear that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I think the administration needs to do a better job of explaining their policies and clarifying their policies, because you hear this all the time, and it's something that it's difficult. The administration hasn't really addressed it adequately. So, I mean, they need to say pretty clearly, you know, here's what health care is, here's what it'll do, here's how it'll help small businesses, here's how it'll help the American economy, and here's the problem of the recession, here's how we got into the recession, here's how we're going to try to get out of that. That overall vision has been missing, and I think the schizophrenia of the Obama administration on economic policy has contributed to that. I asked Democratic pollster Stan Greenberg, what do people think of Obama's economic policies, and Greenberg said, when you ask people what is Obama's economic policy, they don't know. They think maybe it's health care reform. So the fact that the administration has been all over the place, the fact that they passed stimulus and they did health care, then they moved to the deficit, and now they're back to jobs, has confused people. And there needs to be a clarity of a storyline. In the same way that Obama had a story that everyone could latch on to in 2008, he needs to have a similar story about the American economy in 2012 that people can digest.
Right.
And he needs to repeat it over and over and over again so it sticks. Otherwise, the Republican argument, which is government's the problem, uncertainty is the problem, regulation is the problem, that argument is likely to triumph if there's not a counter-narrative to check it.
Here's an email from John. Since it does make economic sense for the government to cut spending and trim deficits in such poor economic conditions, why did S&P downgrade the U.S. credit rating? Was it merely a response to the hysteria generated by the right-wing politicians and media echo chamber, or did that hysteria generate that concern, real concern, in the markets?
I think it was mostly based on the dysfunction of the American political system and the inability of the American political system to look like it could solve sort of routine economic problems. So you realize, you know, in years past, we had just raised the debt ceiling without having any sort of argument over it. The fact that we had this hostage situation, the fact that spooked the markets, that led to the downgrade. Now, I think it was still a mistake to downgrade by S&P because it ended up doing more harm than good. But if you look at what the markets are calling for, particularly the bond market in the past has worried about things like inflation and has been one of the main drivers of pushing for reducing the deficit. Now they're saying the exact opposite. Now they're saying that we need more government intervention, not less, to be able to give the markets a boost and to be able to give the American economy a boost. And so really, there's sort of a role reversal where the markets themselves are a lot less spooked about the deficit than they have been in years past, and are much more on the side of stimulus. And if you want to see a good example of this, I mean, look at Bill Gross and Mohammed El-Arian of PIMCO, you know, which is a huge bond trading company, and they've been very outspoken that the focus on austerity right now is the wrong way to go, that creating jobs more than anything would reassure an anxious markets and would boost the U.S. economy at this point in time.
Let's take a chance. We've got about 45 seconds. So, Matt from Lake Geneva, you're on. Make it quick.
Oh, thank you. You know, we need manufacturing jobs. We've lost them over the last 20 years. And it's the monetary policy. You know, if you were had money to invest in a business, you wouldn't do it. You'd put it in the financial markets because Alan Greenspan and Ben Bernanke and their economic central planning made people, you know, had these unintended consequences. And, you know, so now economic central planning has failed.
All right. 15 seconds, Ari.
Well, that's one part of it. I mean, there's a long history of a loss of manufacturing and why we need manufacturing. I absolutely agree that we need to have more manufacturing in this country, but it has to be part of a larger economic solution. And that's something that the public cares a lot about, and politicians in Washington aren't doing enough to address.
Ari, thank you. You're a great guest. Have fun in the snow.
Thanks, Kathleen. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Ari.
Always fun to talk to you.
Ari Berman, contributing writer for The Nation magazine, investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His piece is in the current Nation, October 19 is the byline, the date line, How the Austerity Class Rules Washington. It's on our Facebook page in case you'd like to read it in its entirety. You will find it very interesting. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the program. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for doing on-air production in our downtown Milwaukee studios. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. We'll continue our conversation in a moment.